Okay, let's unpack this. Picture a high-flying executive, someone you'd assume is financially savvy, right? Casually knocking over a $500 lamp in a fancy restaurant. Instead of a simple sorry, they peel off $5,000 and tell the manager to keep the change.
Wow, 5,000.
$5,000 for a broken lamp. And here's where it gets really interesting. Despite this apparent, abundance of wealth, the same person eventually ended up with absolutely nothing.
Nothing.
Zero. What's the disconnect there?
Well, it immediately throws into question the idea that financial success is purely about intelligence or professional achievement, doesn't it?
Right.
This story highlights that there's a significant difference between being smart and behaving wisely with money.
Exactly. And that's precisely what we're diving into today. The surprising truth is that doing well with money often has far more to do with your behavior than with your IQ or like your knowledge of the stock market. And as we all know, even for the most intelligent people, changing those ingrained behaviors can be a real challenge.
If we step back and look at the bigger picture, we're really talking about the psychology of money. It's not just about numbers and charts. It's about our individual histories, the unique tapestry of our life experiences, and how those shape our perceptions and ultimately our actions when it comes to finance. These deeply personal influences often lead us to make financial decisions that might seem illogical, maybe even crazy to others.
So when we talk about your story of money, what we mean is.
It's that unique set of beliefs, attitudes, and behaviors you've developed towards finance based purely on your life experiences. Everyone's got one.
Right. And this fascinating intersection of our minds and our money is what captivated the author whose work we're exploring today. As a finance writer since the tumultuous 2008 financial crisis,
Oh, yeah, that time.
a time when it genuinely felt like the financial world had gone a bit sideways, they became increasingly aware of the inadequacy of purely rational explanations.
Because they just didn't add up.
Exactly. For every expert analysis, there seemed to be a contradictory yet equally plausible counterargument. This led them to investigate the often overlooked human element driving financial decisions.
And what's particularly insightful about this shift in focus is the recognition that the inconsistencies and the seemingly irrational behavior observed during and after the crisis weren't just random noise. They were signals pointing to deeper, more emotional drivers behind people's financial choices. This author realized that to truly understand why people behave the way they do with money, you need to look beyond the spreadsheets and delve into their personal experiences and psychological biases.
Absolutely. And that's where the crucial understanding comes in, that everyone, including you listening right now, has their own completely unique story of money. The financial world looks different through everyone's eyes because we've all walked different paths. What might seem like the most obvious and sensible financial step to you could appear utterly baffling to someone else, and vice versa.
It really boils down to the diverse set of experiences that have shaped our individual perspectives.
Which also highlights why this material is so relevant to you, our listener. Understanding these psychological forces at play can provide valuable insights into your own financial behaviors and help you navigate the complexities of money with greater self-awareness.
And this notion that what seems crazy to you might make sense to me is a foundational insight, really.
It is.
Without understanding the specific context of someone's life, their background, their formative financial experiences, it's almost impossible to truly grasp the logic behind their financial decisions. It underscores the importance of empathy and recognizing that there isn't always one right way to think about money.
Okay, so let's really dig into this power of experience. Our sources emphasize just how profoundly our personal histories, even stuff that might seem small or insignificant within the vast global financial landscape, can influence our financial worldview.
It's huge.
In fact, our individual experiences can account for as much as a staggering 80% of how we believe the financial world operates.
80%. That's massive.
It is. The core insight here is that your entire financial reality can be significantly shaped by the specific economic conditions and personal circumstances you first encountered.
And what's fascinating here is how this understanding challenges the traditional economic assumption that financial decisions are primarily driven by, rational analysis and access to information.
Right, the rational actor model.
Exactly. Instead, it strongly suggests that our gut reactions, our deeply ingrained beliefs and instincts about money, are largely a product of what we have personally lived through.
Consider this. Someone who grew up in a household grappling with poverty will inevitably develop a fundamentally different perception of risk and reward, compared to someone who was raised in a wealthy family with a secure financial foundation.
Oh, absolutely.
For one, the fear of losing everything might be an abstract concept, while for the other, it could be a very real lived memory or a constant underlying anxiety.
So that illustrates a key takeaway. Those early experiences with financial insecurity can create a lasting aversion to risk, can't they?
Definitely. And this impact of experience extends across various economic conditions. Someone who came of age during a period of high and unpredictable inflation.
Like the 70s.
Right. They'll likely develop a very different approach to saving, spending, and investing than someone who has only ever known a period of relatively stable prices.
Their formative experiences have literally wired their brains differently when it comes to the perceived value and purchasing power of money over time.
So the economic environment you experience in your formative years can have a really long-lasting impact on your financial habits and outlook.
Yeah, it sticks with you.
Absolutely. The source material provides compelling examples. Imagine a stockbroker who started their career and lived through the harrowing experience of the Great Depression.
Can you imagine?
Their entire professional life and outlook on the stability of markets would be indelibly shaped by that catastrophic event. Now contrast that with a tech worker who entered the workforce in the late 1990s.
Dot-com boom time.
Exactly. During a period of incredible economic boom and seemingly endless technological growth, they're operating with completely different baseline assumptions about the nature of financial markets.
So the core insight there is that different economic eras foster really different financial mindsets.
Totally. The geographical element is also a critical factor. An Australian who has lived through 3 decades without a significant recession.
That's a long time.
Will have a fundamentally different understanding and expectation of economic stability compared to someone living in a country that has experienced multiple economic downturns during the same period.
Their fundamental assumptions about the resilience of the economy will be vastly different. It highlights that your geographical context and the prevailing economic stability of your region significantly influence your financial expectations and risk tolerance.
And this isn't just based on anecdotal observations, right?
No, there's data.
Economists Melman, D.A. and Nagel conducted a rigorous study analyzing 50 years of data from the Survey of Consumer Finances and their findings.
Yeah, they found that individual investors' willingness to take on financial risk wasn't correlated with their intelligence or level of education.
Which you might expect.
Right. But it was directly and significantly linked to their personal history of experiencing market volatility.
It's, as the source eloquently puts it, often just the dumb luck of when and where you were born that shapes our financial risk tolerance.
That quote really hits home. It provides empirical evidence that our personal experiences act as powerful and often unconscious drivers of our financial risk-taking behavior.
Yeah, this study provides strong empirical support for the idea that our individual experiences act as powerful and enduring anchors for our financial behavior. It moves the conversation away from a purely rational model of decision-making and emphasizes the profound influence of our lived realities. It's not necessarily about who is inherently smarter or more financially literate. Mm. It's often about who has lived through which specific economic conditions and events.
Even prominent and highly successful figures in finance acknowledge this. Mm-hmm. Bill Gross, the famous bond manager.
The bond king, yeah.
He openly admitted that his huge success in the bond market was largely due to the generational sustained decline in interest rates that perfectly coincided with most of his career.
Right place, right time.
For him, during that specific historical period, bonds were indeed reliable wealth-generating assets. However, someone from his father's generation, who lived through periods of high inflation and volatile interest rates, might have viewed bonds with a much more cautious, even skeptical eye.
That just illustrates that the perceived wisdom and effectiveness of different investment strategies can be heavily dependent on the prevailing economic climate of your time.
Exactly. It underscores how the very same financial instrument or asset class can be perceived and valued in radically different ways depending on the specific historical context and an individual's personal experience within it.
Yeah. What looks great to one generation.
It might seem terrible to the next based on what they lived through.
Let's take the example of inflation again, just to make this really clear. If you were a teenager or in your early 20s in 1960s and 70s America,
you saw prices triple.
Right. You witnessed firsthand as prices more than tripled. That kind of experience leaves a deep and lasting impression. You vividly remember the long gas lines, the palpable feeling of the shrinking purchasing power of your hard-earned paycheck.
But if you were born in the 1990s or later, inflation has generally been relatively low and stable for your entire life.
Pretty much a non-issue for many.
Right. It's likely never been a significant or pressing economic concern in your personal experience. These fundamentally different experiences lead to drastically different perspectives on the risks and rewards of holding cash, taking on debt, or investing in assets perceived as hedges against inflation.
And these divergent experiences create fundamental and often unconscious differences in how people approach crucial financial decisions like spending habits, savings priorities, and investment strategies.
Someone who lived through high inflation might be naturally more risk-averse with fixed income, maybe prioritize tangible assets, whereas someone who only knew low inflation might be more comfortable with leverage, maybe chasing growth without worrying much about inflation eating it away.
And it's crucial to remember that these varied financial realities aren't just about broad economic trends affecting entire generations. Even within the same specific time period, different demographic groups can experience wildly different financial circumstances.
That's a really important point.
For instance, during the 2009 recession, while the national unemployment rate peaked around 10%, the unemployment rate for young African-American males without a high school diploma reached nearly 50% in some areas.
50%? That's devastating.
Meanwhile, highly educated older white women experienced unemployment rates below 5%. These are starkly different economic realities occurring simultaneously within the same major economic event.
Yeah, the key takeaway there is that macroeconomic events can have vastly unequal impacts across different segments of the population.
Definitely.
Significantly shaping their financial perspectives and future decision-making processes in very distinct ways.
These stark differences in lived realities powerfully demonstrate how even a single significant macroeconomic event can have profoundly unequal impacts.
And these unequal impacts, in turn, shape the financial perspectives, risk tolerances, and future financial decisions of these groups in very distinct and long-lasting ways. It highlights that the economy isn't some monolithic thing.
Oh, yeah.
It's a collection of individual experiences.
The source even provides a stark historical contrast, looking at the devastation of World War II in countries like Germany and Japan,
where everything was wiped out.
Local stock markets decimated. Basic necessities like food became incredibly scarce. Compare that to the United States during the same period.
Which was booming.
The U.S. stock market actually doubled, and the overall economy experienced a significant boom. Can you even begin to imagine the incredibly different and lasting impact of such drastically contrasting experiences on people's lifelong views?
No, it's hard to fathom. Someone who directly witnessed such complete and utter economic destruction would likely develop a much more cautious, perhaps even deeply pessimistic, long-term outlook on the stability and predictability of financial markets.
Understandably so.
Compared to someone who experienced unprecedented levels of economic growth and widespread prosperity during the very same historical era, these kinds of foundational life-altering experiences are incredibly powerful in shaping our fundamental beliefs about how the financial world works and our place within it.
Okay, shifting gears slightly, let's talk about how understanding this applies to, you know, our listeners.
Right, the practical side.
Understanding this power of experience is really the first step towards greater financial self-awareness. Recognizing that your own financial beliefs and behaviors are deeply rooted in your unique journey. That can help you identify potential biases and blind spots.
Mm-hmm. It encourages you to consider perspectives different from your own and to avoid making generalizations based solely on your personal experiences.
Which can lead to more informed and well-rounded financial decision making.
Exactly. And a key actionable insight here is to actively reflect on your own story of money.
Yeah. Take a minute to think about it.
What were your early experiences with finance? What economic conditions did you grow up in? What messages about money did you get from your family, your community? Understanding these influences can help you make more conscious choices about your financial future.
Rather than just reactive.
Rather than being unknowingly driven by past experiences that might not even be relevant anymore.
And just a peek behind the curtain, our exploration of this involved looking at quite a bit of research and history to back up the author's points.
Yeah, we dug into it.
What really stood out was how consistently traditional finance seems to overlook this crucial human element. We wanted to bring you this deep dive to provide a more holistic, more relatable understanding of why we behave the way we do with money.
And I'll admit, even as someone who studies this stuff, Delving into the depth of how personal history shapes our decisions has been quite eye-opening. It reinforces the idea that finance is far more nuanced and human than just, math problems.
It really is. Now, while we don't have live interactive elements here, we always encourage you, our listeners, to reflect on these questions.
Definitely.
What aspects of your financial journey have most shaped your current views? Maybe chat about it with friends or family. You might be surprised by the different perspectives that come up.
And check out our show notes for this deep dive. We'll include links to some of the research mentioned, plus further reading on the psychology of money.
Yeah, resources to keep exploring if you're interested.
So as you go about your day, maybe just consider the invisible forces of your own financial history at play.
Recognizing these influences isn't about excusing poor decisions, is it?
No, not at all. It's about gaining a deeper understanding of yourself and others in the complex world of money. It's about acknowledging that what seems like common sense in your financial world might be a completely foreign concept in someone else's.
All because of the unique stories we've lived. Now let's pivot to how this applies to specific decisions, sometimes ones that look, well, crazy on the surface.
Right, the same logic behind seemingly crazy choices. The core idea is that every financial decision, no matter how odd it looks from the outside, makes sense to the person making it in that specific moment.
Because it's shaped by their unique experiences and the stories they tell themselves about how money works.
Exactly. Take the example of lottery tickets. Statistically, we know the odds are terrible, right?
Astronomical odds against winning big.
Yet, studies often show that people in lower income brackets tend to spend a higher percentage of their income on lottery tickets compared to wealthier individuals. From a purely rational standpoint, that seems illogical.
Yeah, why spend scarce money on something with such a low probability of return?
But if you try to understand the potential subconscious reasoning, the story they might be telling themselves. For someone facing limited economic mobility, maybe feeling trapped, that lottery ticket might represent the only tangible glimmer of hope for a dramatically better life. It's buying a dream, however improbable.
It's less about the odds and more about the possibility, however remote.
Precisely. It's a small price to pay for the feeling, even if fleeting, that things could change overnight. Someone with financial security, with multiple avenues for advancement, might struggle to intuitively grasp that perspective because their reality is so different.
They don't need that specific kind of hope in the same way.
Exactly. Their story involves different pathways to achieving financial goals. So what looks irrational is actually quite reasonable within the context of that person's lived experience and perceived options.
That's a powerful example. It also connects to something else the source highlights.
Yeah.
How new a lot of our modern financial expectations actually are.
Oh, incredibly new in the grand scheme of things. Think about retirement. The idea that everyone should diligently save for decades to fund their own retirement is a relatively recent concept.
We sort of take it for granted now, but it wasn't always the norm.
Not at all. Until roughly the 1980s, average Social Security checks were quite low in the U.S., and poverty rates among the elderly were significantly higher than they are today.
So the safety net wasn't as strong.
And there's this myth that, oh, everyone used to have a great private pension from their company.
Yeah, you hear that sometimes.
But the data doesn't really support that widespread narrative. In 1975, for example, only about a quarter of Americans over 65 actually received any income from a private pension.
Only a quarter. That's much lower than the perception.
Much lower. The source even quotes the New York Times from 1955 talking about how people desired to retire but simply couldn't afford to. The means weren't there for most people.
Wow. 1955.
And think about the specific tools we rely on today. The 401k. That was basically created by a sort of legislative accident in 1978.
Really? An accident?
Well, a provision intended for something else was interpreted in a way that allowed for tax-deferred savings. It wasn't initially designed as the primary retirement vehicle for the masses, and the Roth IRA. That only came about in 1998.
So these cornerstones of modern retirement planning are really quite young.
Extremely young. The widespread shift towards individual responsibility for retirement funding is a phenomenon of the last few decades. We're basically the first few generations expected to navigate this complex financial planning landscape largely on our own.
We're still figuring it out, in a way. We don't have centuries of ingrained cultural knowledge about managing Roth IRAs.
Exactly. We're learning as we go, which makes the psychological aspect, the stories we tell ourselves, the experiences we draw on, even more critical because the historical precedents are so limited.
That naturally leads into another key theme, the interplay of luck and skill. And the difference between getting wealthy and staying wealthy.
Yes, this is crucial. Luck and risk are two sides of the same coin. Outcomes in finance, like in life, are heavily influenced by forces entirely outside of our individual control or effort.
We like to think it's all about our brilliant decisions, but reality is messier.
Much messier. The source uses the example of Bill Gates, obviously brilliant, driven, worked incredibly hard, but he also attended one of the only high schools in the world at that time that had a computer.
Right, that Lakeside School connection.
And his close friend and early partner, Ken Evans, who was equally brilliant and shared that same drive, tragically died in a mountaineering accident before Microsoft even took off.
Wow, I didn't know that story.
Same skill, same drive, wildly different outcomes due purely to luck, one incredibly good, one incredibly bad. It's a stark reminder.
So we need to be cautious about attributing success solely to skill and failure solely to bad decisions.
Exactly. It's easy to look at someone successful and think they did everything right, and someone who failed and think they must have made terrible mistakes. But luck plays a huge role we often underestimate.
The source uses the anecdote of Cornelius Vanderbilt, the railroad tycoon, basically disregarding the law when challenged, reportedly saying something like, "Law. What do I care about law? Ain't I got the power?"
Bold move.
It's an example of how a bold, even reckless action can succeed spectacularly due to circumstance, luck, or sheer power, but the same action, under slightly different circumstances, could lead to ruin.
It highlights that risk-taking pays off sometimes, but it's often hard to distinguish between bold genius and reckless folly until after the fact.
Even someone like Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing, known for his rigid rules about diversification.
The ultimate rational investor, supposedly.
His personal fortune relied heavily on a massive, concentrated investment in GEICO insurance very early on. It made him incredibly wealthy, but it completely violated his own diversification principles.
So, was that a moment of supreme shrewdness, seeing something others missed? Or was it, a lucky break that happened to work out spectacularly well?
It's hard to say definitively, isn't it? It blurs the line.
It really does. And this leads to the difference between getting wealthy and staying wealthy. They aren't the same skill set.
How so?
Getting wealthy often involves taking risks, being optimistic, maybe being bold, like Vanderbilt or Graham with GEICO. Staying wealthy, however, requires a different mindset. It requires survival.
Survival, meaning.
Meaning avoiding catastrophic loss. It requires a degree of paranoia, recognizing that luck can turn against you. The source contrasts Jesse Livermore,
Famous trader.
made a fortune shorting the market before the 1929 crash.
Yeah.
Genius timing, incredible skill, got very wealthy, but he kept taking huge risks, eventually lost it all, and tragically took his own life.
He got wealthy but didn't stay wealthy.
Exactly. Contrast him with someone like Abraham Germanski, a real estate developer who was also reportedly ruined by the 1929 crash and sadly disappeared. Both achieved wealth, neither could hold on to it when the tide turned violently.
So staying wealthy is about avoiding that wipeout risk.
Precisely. It's about ensuring you can stay in the game long enough for the long-term advantages, like compounding, to work. Getting wealthy might require risk-taking. Staying wealthy requires humility and an obsession with not losing everything.
Which connects to the idea of compounding, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You need time.
You absolutely need time, and survival is the prerequisite for having enough time. The source uses a statistic that something like 40% of publicly traded companies eventually lose almost all their value over time.
40%. That's a lot of potential wipeouts in a portfolio.
It is. So survival, avoiding those big losses that take you out of the game, is paramount for long-term success. Michael Moritz from Sequoia Capital, the venture capital firm, is quoted saying, "Their success isn't just about backing winners.
It's about what?
It's about the fear of going out of business. That constant awareness that things can go wrong is what helps them endure over the long haul."
That paranoia again.
A healthy dose of it, yeah, because that's what allows compounding to really work its magic.
Let's talk about compounding then. It's often mentioned, but maybe not fully grasped.
It's powerful, but counterintuitive. Compounding requires uninterrupted time. You need to survive the inevitable market ups and downs to let it work.
And the results aren't linear.
Not at all. That's the key. Our brains tend to think linearly, like 8 plus 8 plus 8 will 24. Compounding is exponential, like 8, 8, 8, 8 was 5, 12. Small differences in growth rates sustained over long periods lead to dramatically different outcomes.
The classic example is Warren Buffett.
Right. People focus on his incredible wealth, but
Yeah.
the source points out his success isn't just about achieving exceptionally high average annual returns. His returns are amazing, around 22% annually.
Which is fantastic.
Fantastic, yes. But the real kicker is that he's been doing it consistently since he was a teenager, and he's lived a long time. His wealth is largely a product of a good return, compounded over an incredibly long time horizon, like 70 plus years.
Time is the secret ingredient.
It's a massive ingredient. The source contrasts Buffett with Jim Simons of Renaissance Technologies. Simons has achieved phenomenal annual returns since 1988, averaging something like 66% per year.
66%, that's astronomical.
It is. Far higher than Buffett's average. But Simons started later in life. The source does a hypothetical calculation. If Simons had earned his 66% annual return over the same 70-plus year period that Buffett has been investing,
oh boy,
his net worth wouldn't just be billions, it would be a number so ridiculously large it's hard to even comprehend, like trillions upon trillions. It perfectly illustrates the insane power of compounding over very long time frames.
Because that exponential growth just goes vertical after enough time.
Exactly. 8 times 8 times 8. Keep multiplying. It's why starting early, even with smaller amounts, is so crucial. And more importantly, why staying invested, surviving the downturns, is the key to unlocking that long-term power. You need longevity.
Which brings us back to survival and the concept of having a margin of safety or room for error.
Yes, a really critical but often underappreciated concept. Margin of safety isn't just about being conservative. It's about building buffers into your financial life that allow you to survive setbacks and unexpected events without being forced out of your long-term plan.
It's like having a cushion.
Exactly. It could be a frugal budget that leaves you with excess savings each month. It could be flexible thinking, not being rigidly tied to one specific outcome. It could be having a loose timeline for your financial goals so a market downturn doesn't force you to sell at the worst possible time.
It's about resilience.
It's about resilience and increasing the odds that you can stick around long enough for things to work out, even when you hit bumps, because you will hit bumps. The source uses an interesting analogy. Brain synapse pruning in children.
How does that relate?
As kids grow, their brains actually eliminate connections that aren't used. It seems like destruction, like loss. But it's actually a crucial part of developing a more efficient and powerful, mature brain.
So getting rid of some things makes the whole system stronger.
Precisely. Similarly, surviving setbacks, even taking small losses or enduring periods of underperformance, can be part of a resilient long-term financial strategy if it prevents a catastrophic, game-ending loss.
It requires embracing some imperfection.
Absolutely. Look at U.S. economic history over the last, say, 170 years. Living standards are up something like 20-fold. Incredible progress.
Unprecedented, really.
But during that same period, the stock market has had numerous sharp declines. There have been devastating recessions, periods of high inflation, wars, incredible volatility along the way.
So you needed both optimism about the long-term potential and paranoia about the short-term risks to navigate that successfully.
Exactly. You need room for error to endure the downturn so you can benefit from the long-term upturn. Successful investing doesn't require being right all the time. Peter Lynch, the legendary Fidelity manager, famously said.
What did he say?
If you're terrific in this business, you're right 6 times out of 10.
Only 6 out of 10. For a terrific investor.
Yeah. It implies you're wrong quite often. The key is ensuring that your wins are bigger than your losses, and that none of your losses wipe you out completely.
It's about surviving the mistakes.
And understanding that mistakes will happen. Jeff Bezos talks about failures at Amazon, like the Fire Phone.
Oh yeah, that was a big one.
A huge expensive flock. But he frames it as okay, because the successes, the tails, like Amazon Web Services, which was initially just an internal tool, are so massive they more than compensate for the failures. You need room for error to allow for those experiments, some of which will fail.
George Soros had a quote about this too, right?
Yeah, something like, it's not whether you're right or wrong that's important, but how much money you make when you're right and how much you lose when you're wrong.
It's the magnitude, not just the frequency. Margin of safety helps you survive the wrongs.
Perfectly put. It lets you stay in the game to capitalize on the rights.
This ties into another concept, the allure of enough. Knowing when to stop chasing more.
Yes, a really profound point. What's the ultimate goal of accumulating wealth? The source argues powerfully that the highest dividend money pays is control over your time.
For you.
Freedom, the ability to wake up and say, I can do whatever I want today. That's incredibly valuable, maybe the most valuable thing.
More valuable than a bigger house or a faster car.
Often, yes. There's research by Angus Campbell mentioned, finding that having a strong sense of controlling one's life is a much better predictor of happiness and well-being than objective factors like salary level or job title prestige.
The feeling of autonomy.
Exactly. The source contrasts the typical path of chasing high-paying but incredibly demanding jobs, like investment banking, where you work insane hours.
Trading time for money, essentially.
With the freedom gained from simply having enough to cover your needs and wants without being beholden to a soul-crushing job, there's a story of a musician who felt wealthy at 22 just because he had enough saved to live simply and focus on his music.
He had control over his time.
He did, and it points to a paradox. The U.S. is arguably the wealthiest nation in history, yet happiness levels haven't necessarily increased compared to, say, the 1950s when people had far less stuff.
So we traded something.
Perhaps we traded control over our time and a slower pace of life for more consumer goods and the pressure that comes with maintaining that lifestyle. We got richer, but maybe lost some autonomy along the way.
The idea of work has changed too, hasn't it? With knowledge work.
Definitely. The source uses John D. Rockefeller as an example. Even when he was running Standard Oil, his work wasn't constant physical labor or even being in meetings all day. It was primarily thinking, strategizing, making a few key decisions.
More like bursts of focused thought.
Yes, a model that's maybe more relevant to today's knowledge workers. But the problem is, our work feels constant now because of technology. There's a quote about the wise old owl.
How does that go?
The wise old owl lived in an oak. The more he saw, the less he spoke. The less he spoke, the more he heard. Why can't we all be like that wise old bird?
Yeah.
It suggests value in quiet contemplation, not constant activity.
But our phones and laptops make work inescapable.
Right. Derek Thompson's idea is referenced. The modern factory is not a place at all. It is the day itself. Work follows you everywhere through portable technology, blurring the lines, and potentially reducing that sense of control over your time.
Which makes defining enough even more important so you can reclaim some of that control.
Exactly. Knowing your enough point allows you to step off the hamster wheel.
Related to this, there's the paradox of wealth and wanting to be liked or admired.
Ah, this is a fascinating psychological insight. People often desire wealth. Consciously or subconsciously, because they think it will make others like and admire them.
If I have that fancy car, people will respect me.
Something like that. But the irony is, when others see that fancy car, they rarely think, wow, the owner is so cool. Instead, they often use the car as a benchmark for their own desires.
They think, wow, I want a car like that.
Precisely. They admire the car, not necessarily the person driving it. The wealth becomes a reference point for their own aspirations rather than a reason to admire the owner.
There's a story about a valet, right?
Yeah, a valet who worked at a high-end hotel. He saw tons of fancy cars, Ferraris, Porsches. He observed that the people driving them weren't always super wealthy. Often they were just spending a very high percentage of their income to look wealthy.
Keeping up appearances.
Exactly. And it highlights a crucial point. True wealth is often what you don't see. It's the assets not spent, the investments quietly compounding, the financial security that doesn't require flashy signals.
Which makes it hard to learn about wealth by imitation. You can imitate spending, but you can't easily imitate not spending.
You got it. The source mentions Ronald Reed, the janitor and gas station attendant who secretly amassed an $8 million fortune through frugal living and smart investing.
The ultimate example of unseen wealth.
Right. He was admired posthumously when his story came out, but during his life, nobody looked at him as a financial role model because his wealth was invisible. You can't aspire to be like someone if you don't know what they're doing.
So humility and maybe being less flashy are actually components of building and keeping wealth.
It often seems that way. Less ego, more wealth. Which leads directly to the importance of saving.
The simple act of spending less than you earn.
It sounds basic, but the source argues that building wealth often has more to do with your savings rate than your income level or even your investment returns.
More important than picking the perfect stock.
Often, yes, especially over the long term. High income doesn't guarantee wealth if you spend it all. Fantastic investment returns don't build wealth if you haven't saved anything to invest in the first place. Your savings rate is one of the factors you can control most directly.
Control is key again.
Mm-hmm. There is an analogy to the 1970s oil crisis. When supply was tight and prices spiked, one of the most effective solutions wasn't just finding more oil, it was increasing energy efficiency.
Using less.
Conservation.
Exactly. Reducing consumption, doing more with less. Similarly, in personal finance, increasing your efficiency, your savings rate, by controlling your spending can be more powerful than just trying to earn more or chase higher returns.
And the value of wealth is always relative to your needs, isn't it?
Absolutely critical point. Wealth isn't an absolute number. It's relative to what you need and want. Imagine two investors. both with a net worth of $1 million.
Okay.
Investor A needs $80,000 per year to maintain their lifestyle. Investor B only needs $40,000 per year. Who is wealthier in a practical sense? Investor B, right? Their $1 million goes twice as far, gives them more security, more options.
Exactly. The person with lower needs and expenses is effectively wealthier, even with the same nominal net worth, because their money provides more runway, more freedom, more margin for error. Building wealth is as much about defining and managing your needs as it is about accumulating assets.
Which maybe means we shouldn't always strive for purely rational financial decisions, but perhaps reasonable ones.
Ah, the reasonable versus rational distinction. This is a great insight. Traditional finance often focuses on finding the mathematically optimal, purely rational solution.
Like the portfolio with the highest expected return for a given level of risk.
Right. But the source argues that in the real world, being strictly rational isn't always sustainable or even desirable. Sometimes being reasonable is better.
What's the difference?
Reasonable means acknowledging that we're humans with emotions, biases, and real-world constraints. A reasonable decision might not be perfectly optimal on paper, but it's one you can actually stick with long-term because it doesn't cause you excessive stress or regret.
Like avoiding a strategy that keeps you up at night, even if it looks good in the spreadsheet.
Exactly. The analogy used is fighting a fever. Medically, a mild fever might have some marginal benefits in fighting infection. But do we let it run its course?
No, we take medicine because it feels awful.
Precisely. We treat the symptom because the discomfort isn't worth the marginal benefit. Similarly, in investing, avoiding strategies that cause too much emotional pain, even if they're theoretically rational, is often the reasonable thing to do because it helps you stay invested.
Harry Markowitz, who won a Nobel Prize for modern portfolio theory, apparently did this himself.
Yeah, the story goes that when setting up his own retirement investments, despite his complex optimization models, he initially just split his money 50-50 between bonds and equities. His reasoning. He wanted to minimize his potential future regret. He knew he couldn't perfectly predict the future, and a simple 50-50 split felt like a balanced approach that wouldn't leave him feeling terrible regardless of whether stocks or bonds did better. That's a reasonable decision driven by emotion, not purely rational optimization.
It acknowledges the human element.
It does. Trying to be purely rational can lead to absurdities. Like, theoretically, if you believe stocks will outperform bonds long term, the rational thing might be to stay 100% in stocks, maybe even leveraged. But could you actually stick with that through a 50% crash?
Probably not. Panic selling would be a huge risk.
Right. Or the example of staying leveraged 2.1. If the market drops 50%, you're wiped out. The rational model might say, rebalance back to 2.1 leverage, but you can't if you have zero capital left. Reasonableness acknowledges reality.
So reasonable finance might include things that aren't strictly optimal.
Yes. Things like having a slight home bias in your portfolio, investing more in your own country's stocks than global diversification models might suggest, maybe because it feels more comfortable or familiar.
Or maybe even doing a tiny bit of day trading with play money if you genuinely enjoy it and it doesn't derail your main strategy.
Potentially, yes. If it scratches an itch and prevents you from tinkering destructively with your core portfolio, making economic forecasts, even though we know they're usually wrong, might be reasonable if the process helps you think through scenarios.
Even Jack Bogle, founder of Vanguard and index fund champion.
Yeah, apparently invested some money in his son's actively managed higher fee funds. Not rationally optimal according to his own philosophy.
But reasonable for family reasons.
Presumably. It shows that real life involves factors beyond pure financial logic. Aiming for reasonable, sustainable strategies often beats chasing perfect rationality.
That seems like a much more forgiving and realistic approach. Now, related to reasonableness is how we perceive risk and outlook.
Mm.
Why does pessimism seem so seductive?
Ah, the seduction of pessimism. It's a well-observed phenomenon. Pessimism often sounds smarter and more plausible than optimism.
Why is that?
Several reasons. One, bad news demands attention. If someone tells you your house might burn down, you listen. If they say your house value might go up slightly, it's less urgent. Pessimism signals potential danger that affects everyone.
Optimism can sound naive.
It can sound like salesmanship or wishful thinking, while pessimism sounds like cautious, critical analysis. The source mentions an outlandish forecast from 2008 by a Russian professor predicting the breakup of the United States.
Erase.
Published seriously in the Wall Street Journal. People take extreme pessimism much more seriously than extreme optimism. Imagine predicting imminent utopia, you'd likely be dismissed.
There are quotes about this too, right? Matt Ridley, Hans Rosling.
Yeah, they both observed this human tendency towards pessimism despite overwhelming evidence of long-term global progress in health, poverty reduction, etc. John Stuart Mill noted way back that people admire those who despair when others hope.
Why is financial pessimism so common?
Because money is ubiquitous. A potential problem in the economy or markets feels like it could affect everyone, unlike, say, a specific scientific problem. And setbacks often happen quickly and dramatically.
Like a market crash, a bankruptcy, a war.
Exactly. They're sudden, visible, attention-grabbing. Progress, on the other hand, tends to be slow, incremental, almost invisible day to day.
Like the gradual decline in heart disease deaths over decades or the slow adoption of new technologies.
Right. The Wright brothers flew in 1903, but it took years for people to grasp the airplane's significance. Progress compounds slowly while bad news hits like a thunderclap. Pessimism often feels more relevant because setbacks are easier to see and feel immediately.
So we overweight the dramatic negative and underweight the slow positive.
It seems so. Stephen Hawking, after his diagnosis, reduced his life expectations to basically zero, said that every day after that was a bonus. It's a perspective shift, recognizing that progress itself is remarkable, even if it's slow and uneven.
We need to actively fight that pessimistic bias sometimes.
Especially in long-term investing, where optimism about eventual progress is almost a prerequisite. But it requires acknowledging the bumps along the way, that reasonable paranoia again.
This all ties back to the power of the stories we tell ourselves, doesn't it? How we frame events.
Absolutely fundamental. Our understanding of the world, including finance, isn't based on raw data, but on the narratives we construct to make sense of that data.
We need stories to function.
We do. The source points to the 2008 financial crisis. While there were real economic losses, a huge part of the damage was narrative damage. The story changed. People lost faith in the stability of the financial system, in home ownership as a guaranteed path to wealth, in the expertise of financial institutions.
That loss of confidence had huge real-world consequences.
Immense. Even if the underlying capacity to generate wealth hadn't been completely destroyed, the change in the collective story caused people to behave differently, pull back spending, hoard cash, avoid risk deepening the downturn.
It's like the history of medicine example used.
Yes. For centuries, treatments like bloodletting were widely believed to work, despite often being harmful. Why? Because people were desperate for solutions, and the story that doctors knew what they were doing was more comforting than admitting ignorance or helplessness.
We cling to narratives, even flawed ones, when faced with uncertainty.
We do. It helps explain why people follow questionable investment advice or fall for Ponzi schemes like Bernie Madoff's. The story he told, consistent low-risk returns from an exclusive source, was compelling, especially to people who wanted to believe it.
It fit a narrative they found appealing.
Exactly. The source uses the analogy of an infant trying to make sense of the world. They have very limited information, but they still build a narrative. When I cry, the giant face appears and feeds me. We all do this, constructing mental models based on our limited experiences and information.
And we tend to seek out information that confirms our existing stories.
Confirmation bias, yes. B.H. Liddell Hart, the historian, is quoted on how history is subjective, how people look for evidence that fits their preconceived notions. We do the same in finance.
Daniel Kahneman's work on cognitive biases is relevant here, too.
Hugely relevant. Things like the planning fallacy, underestimating how long things take, neglecting competitor skills while overemphasizing our own, focusing only on what we know and ignoring the vast unknown unknowns.
All leading to overconfidence based on incomplete narratives.
Precisely. We build a compelling story in our heads based on the limited information we have, and then we act on that story with far more confidence than the evidence warrants.
The source concludes this section with an analogy of an alien observing Earth.
Right. An alien could observe stock market charts, economic data, company reports, but without understanding the stories in people's heads, their hopes, fears, biases, unique histories, they would have no real understanding of why prices move or why people make the decisions they do.
The narrative layer is essential context.
It's everything. You have to understand the psychology, the stories, to make sense of the numbers.
Okay, so wrapping this all together, let's distill some key takeaways, maybe framed as actionable advice for listeners, drawn from the sources list of things learned about money.
Sounds good. A big one is, go out of your way to find humility when things are going right. Recognize the role luck played.
Related to that, fewer egos, more wealth. Don't let pride drive decisions. And practically, increase your savings rate. That's often more controllable than returns.
Become okay with a lot of things going wrong in your portfolio or financial plan. Focus on the overall long-term outcome, not every single decision being perfect. You need that room for error.
Use money primarily to gain control over your time. That's the real prize.
Be nicer and less flashy. Wealth is often silent. Trying too hard to signal it can be counterproductive.
Save without a specific goal sometimes. Just building that buffer, that margin of safety, provides invaluable flexibility.
Define the cost of success. Volatility, uncertainty, doubt, regret, and be willing to pay it. It's the fee for long-term returns. Don't expect gains without occasional pain.
Worship room for error. Build those buffers.
Avoid the extreme ends of financial decisions. Extreme frugality or extreme leverage are both fragile. Balance is usually more resilient.
Recognize that your risk tolerance will likely change, especially as you get older. What feels acceptable when you're young might feel terrifying later. Understand why you feel the way you do about risk now.
Define the game you're playing. Are you a short-term trader or a long-term investor? Don't try to play someone else's game or switch constantly based on what's hot. Stick to your strategy.
Respect the mess. Understand that finance is messy, complex, and driven by unpredictable human behavior, not clean formulas.
Beware the seduction of pessimism, but don't ignore risks. Maintain that balance of optimism and paranoia.
Realize that when you believe anything and everything, especially compelling narratives without scrutiny, you become captive to those stories. Be critical.
Except that pretty much all economic and investing forecasts are just variations of, we don't know what's going to happen next. Humility is key.
Expect big surprises. Things happen that nobody predicts. That's why margin of safety is so vital.
Be wary of the phrase, it's different this time. It's often dangerous. But also recognize that sometimes things do genuinely change. Context matters.
Understand that there's more foresight and adaptability in the real world than any predictive model can capture.
Resist the strong urge to tell everyone else what to do with their money. Remember, their story is different from yours.
And finally, success is a lousy teacher. It can breed overconfidence and make you ignore the role of luck. Learn more from failures, yours and others.
That's a great list. Really captures the essence of thinking differently about money.
So for a final thought to leave our listeners with, maybe it's this. Truly understanding the psychology of money, acknowledging our unique experiences, the power of stories, the role of luck, the importance of reasonableness over pure rationality might lead to a more grounded, less stressful, and ultimately more successful financial life.
Even if that means challenging conventional wisdom sometimes and definitely embracing the inherent messiness of it all, it's about understanding yourself as much as understanding markets.
So the provocative thought is, take some time to really reflect on your own story of money. How have your past shaped your present decisions? And how might understanding that story help you write a better financial future?